Season 3 of Man in the High Castle has ended, but we are here to talk about it with a special guest. Come on with us.
You're tuned in to AfterBuzz TV, the ESPN of TV talk. Now, let the buzz begin.
We are loud. We are live. It is election night.
Yes.
And we are ready to talk about Man in the High Castle Season 3, Episode 9 and Episode 10. We're full strength here tonight.
We are.
Woo!
Whole crew's back
and
together.
And even more so, because we have
extra
people.
So, I'm Steve Kaufman, here with Carrie Lane.
What's up? And I am live in the chat if you're watching this live.
Yes.
If you're watching it later, please comment down below. And thank you for everybody who has commented on our videos before.
And hey guys, it's your girl Christine Alexis. I'm back. I'm also in the chat, so say hello.
Double trouble in the chat.
Yes.
And that's not all, folks. We have a very special guest joining us on the after show. For the second time, Joel De La Fuente, thank you so much for joining us.
How are you?
How are you?
You guys are so adorable watching you guys during as you gear up. That was like for me, my evening is made.
Aww.
Well, you just made ours.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah.
It is
Wait.
Over. It's
Equal.
Done.
Yes.
Great, we can call it. Good show.
Yeah. All right, guys.
Okay, see you later.
Thank you so much for joining us. I guess the main question would be to ask, how was shooting season 3 versus season 1 or season 2?
Mm. Every season is its own sort of complete crazy adventure, you know. As you may know, we've had a lot of changeover, like in front of and behind the cameras, as the season's gone on. So season 3 was the year of Eric Overmyer. Who took over as showrunner for season 3, a wonderfully nice man, a guy with a lot of really terrific credits, who's done some of my favorite TV shows, including The Wire. So basically it was us getting to work with a whole new group of people upstairs, you know, with the writers and stuff. And I think they had a really ambitious agenda and really tried to push the world really wide and get into all these different areas.
Yeah, that
sounds good.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think season 3 definitely pushed all the boundaries. I think this season, more than previous seasons, we understand more of how this world works, how traveling works, and just get more information on the films than we ever have. So it makes everything feel complete. And your character had such a great arc this season, too. We just saw so many different sides of you. It's been such a pleasure to see.
Oh, thanks, Christina.
Yeah, I was actually talking about it on one of my other shows. Kito has been an interesting character this season, especially a couple scenes that, like, we go from one scene to the next where you just kind of hate him. You're like, no, that's horrible. And the next scene, aw, but he's so nice. Wait, what did he just do a second ago? It's such a character that's, you know, you love him and you kind of hate him.
It's one of the really fun things about him for me, I think. I mean, I think... people are complicated.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you, one of the enjoyable things about this show has been, especially the way that it's framed and the way that it started, there's a very clear sense of who the audience thinks are supposed to be the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sort of start to rotate around everybody and everyone is living, you know, we're all living in a complex, complicated world and everyone has to eat and everyone has their own different beliefs. And so as you sort of start to walk around people, they take on like a more well-rounded, you know, you get more of a sense of paradox, you know, in who these people are.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of touched on it in the sense that in one moment you hate Kito and the next you love him. What was it like for you playing those really dark, intense moments where Kito is really savage? He just disciplines in a way like no other.
You know, it's been a constant dialogue with the writers about, you know, for the whole series about, how to make all of our characters human, you know, and you know, Frank Spotnitz, who adapted the series, and was the first showrunner, we had this great first conversation about how he really loved this idea of really trying to humanize Kito and not playing at these ideas of being a villain or mustache twirling and things like that. And he said, you know, I really love your thought that the audience would at times identify with him and sort of emotionally empathize with him at times. And I said, great, we're on the same page. And then the next day I got the next script and Kito kills Frank's sister and kids. So I thought, I thought, well, sort of putting me behind the eight ball here. And so from that point on, like the more we find things to sort of empathize with him about, you know, like certain things that he does or certain situations, I never forget that you also have to, one must never forget that he's the head of the Japanese secret police and that the Kempe Tai does terrible things. So, you know, it's not something to run away from. So even though I spend a lot of time trying to find ways where I like him and I don't judge him, I also have to embrace and run towards, you know, like what he does with Nakamura, for example. You know, I guess you guys have already talked about that at the end of episode 7.
That was brutal.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was hard to watch.
Yeah. See, that it should be very hard to watch.
You're more okay with that than Frank.
But
what was that about Frank?
I said you're more okay with that than with Frank, though, like us as a viewer, because it's a different kind of...
And the viewer had a different connection with Nakamura than it did with Frank.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the Nakamura scene. How was that? Was there any particular challenge shooting that scene versus any other scene, or what? Like, because I believe that would be one of the more gratuitous scenes this season, aside obviously from the Frank scene that we're going to get to.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's hard also because, you know, in between takes and. You know, we're sort of a family. You work really intensely and intimately with people and with the cast and the crew, and it's hard to do that to anybody. You know, like, and even when you're pretending, and there's safety issues and stuff, you have to be really careful about how you set all that stuff up, and those are fun kind of challenges too. But in the end, it's sort of like you know, you're playing make believe intensely with people that you really care about, and sometimes you're walking that fine line. You know how sometimes you play in the playground and someone ends up crying because things get too intense, and in a scene like that, you're sort of walking in that line.
Well, now I just have to ask: were they retractable bayonets, or was it a full on separate head situation?
Well, they had like the camera ready bayonets, which are real. And then there would be fake ones that we would carry that had rubber tips. On the day when we were sort of stabbing, it really was just a case of having something padded there to stab into, because, you know, the cameras are such high quality now that if you're walking around with a rubber knife, it's just not gonna cut it.
Nice pun there.
Professional.
Great. Well, I was gonna say, speaking of cut it, we have what happens with Frank.
Great transition.
How'd you feel about that?
You know, it's one of those, unless Frank got away, I don't really see another outcome for him. Uh-huh. It was unfortunate because you thought, well, why does Kido really have to go through with that? Like,
I thought about that a lot watching it, because the conversation leading up to the actual moment where you behead him, it seems like you guys are reconciling. It's almost like I felt like Kido needed that moment to find forgiveness for himself, because he was still struggling with the aftermath of the explosion, one, but also he still carried the grief of killing Frank's sister and her kids. So I feel like he needed to get that off of his chest, and Frank needed to say what he wanted to say. But I, for a split second, was like, wait, they're in the middle of the desert. There's no way Frank's coming out of this alive. And that's when I realized you're going to kill him.
I personally thought the term was going to be that they were going to leave him there. You were both going to agree to disagree, and then be like, well, if you can find a way out of this, you deserve to live.
Yeah, but
like, agree to disagree. That's great.
Well, just like
to be agree to disagree.
Oh, well, yeah.
I mean,
it's great to hear your responses to that, though, because you know, so much happens in one scene, and for us, you know, it's a lot to sort of get your head around, and you know, there's just this great expectation and pressure that you want to get it right, you know, not just in the playing of the scene, but whatever the scene is going to be, you know, what we say to each other, how we say it to each other, what the significance of all of it is, because it really is bringing to an end. I mean, obviously, of course, the character of Frank, but just these storylines that have been in place from the beginning. Yeah. So
with a big character death like that, is there a higher level of secrecy around those pages of script versus any other pages of script you may deal with?
Officially, every page is treated pretty secret, like secret.
Of course.
But I think, again, also because we do tend to be sort of a close-knit group, the news of you know, Rupert's death and Luke's too, we knew of those coming up in advance, like coming into the season. And so there was a lot of sensitivity about it and all that. So we were just all sort of secretive about it. But that scene was sort of evolving up until the very end. You know, there were still rewrites being made on that scene the night before we shot it.
Oh wow. Like what kind of changes?
The dialogue, like what we were saying to each other.
But it was, like you said, it was always known that he was still going to die anyway. So that wasn't a change.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, yeah, I like how the scene plays out that Frank knows, too, and he accepts it. And almost, like, Kido lets him have his prayer time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even if we don't agree with Kido's actions, he does have his sense of honor of, and even before he said, I fear a dishonorable death.
Yeah. You know,
so it's, lets Frank have his moment, and it wasn't shocking, it was more disappointing of, oh, darn, he didn't get out, and I would have wanted Frank to somehow survive, but I'm not surprised that he was killed.
I also think the pacing of the scene was such that the death was still sudden. The death was always going to be sudden because the pacing was such that the two of you felt like you could keep talking.
Yeah,
I can get behind that.
That when it happened, it was like, oh, okay.
Well, at least it was a quick one, too. I felt the bayonets was a painful and slow death.
Yeah.
It gave Frank the dignity of a quick, painless death, all things considered.
Yeah.
And even the physical transformation of putting on his uniform, too, to complete the act instead of just his suit.
Mm.
Which was interesting.
It's too messy for Kido. He had to suit up.
Yeah. The idea behind that, too, I think, was to put on his uniform was really to show Frank respect. And that, my perspective, my take on it, which is, it's certainly not the definitive take. I mean, I think hearing what you guys have to say about it and hearing what the viewers have to say about it is so fun and important for us. Because, you know, you work on something so intensely and you think about it and you rethink about it and you rewrite it and you argue and you rehearse. But then once you're done and it's in the can and it's cut together and it goes out there, it stops becoming our thing and it sort of becomes your thing. So for us, it's like really delightful to hear, especially a scene like that or, you know, a lot of these scenes that are really open to interpretation. You know, we obviously have very specific ideas of what we were thinking or doing in the scene, but how you guys receive them is endlessly interesting and gratifying for us because, you know, for me, when I hear people talk about it, there are those people who adore Frank, you know, and so obviously this is going to be a very hard scene for them. And my relationship to them will be very particular.
Sure.
And then there are other people who just, they're maybe a little bit more on my side about it. And so they just sort of are like, they have a different point of view about it. And then there are those people who sort of start to see sort of both sides of the issue. And, and that's interesting too, because if you both know that the death is coming or something like that has to happen, and then it's all about how, like how is the death going to happen? How do they each approach it? And in that respect, I think, I mean, that's how I sort of thought the characters approached it, which was that, I mean, Frank had been preparing for his death all season, it seems like.
They both cheated death in that explosion. Yeah. If you think about it, Kido was just the one to end it.
Yeah. And he'd been atoning, basically. He's been atoning all season. And for Kido, I think so much of it is, I mean, it's got to be one person or the other as far as Kido is concerned. It's like, you know, only one of us can be remaining, and he's fully open to the idea of it being either, but I think, you know, he's sort of the one holding all the cards there. And so really it's just about how are you going to die?
Yeah.
And then the whole conversation they have at the end, for what was surprising for me was just the way that in the end, I think Frank is the only person that Kido can talk to about these things that will understand what he's talking about. They're the only ones who really sort of have an understanding into each other that no one else has. So it's sort of a strange meeting of the respectful minds, and then they do what they have to do.
But isn't that kind of the epitome of a true arch nemesis? Is they have their moments where they're able to talk with their other and really be honest, And it's not even to get them to understand. It's even just like that they feel they can truly say everything. It's
transparency.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, which is what I think that the question about death is, which is, I mean, that's a very intimate question. You know, like, you know, you're not afraid of death. No. Are you afraid of death? Yeah. Well, this is what I'm afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they sort of share that piece of information.
Yeah.
I was from this heavy scene. The next scene we see him with is with Gina, and I love Gina, and Gina and Kito's relationship was so wonderfully beautiful and awkward, and awkward in the sense of they seem like they really liked each other, but it's still this, there's a tension in the air, and it's so crazy to go from the scene with Frank and then to this beautiful thing of here's money, you are free. And then the genuine curiosity, like, what are you going to do with your life? Because he could have done nothing for her. He could have given her the money and then been peace out, not want to talk to her and not care. But he seems to genuinely care. And they get that kiss at the end, which is really sweet. And I'm glad she took it. Like, all right, I do like you. And then he embraces it. You know, it's not just a get off. And so it's just this, if you want to talk about how then that scene, I mean, you probably didn't necessarily film them back to back like that. But but then acting in that kind of a scene after doing Frank's scene or before, or which one came first, and then how was it doing that kind of a scene in comparison?
Interestingly, the Frank scene was the very last scene shot of the season. We finished the whole season, and then it took a couple of weeks because they wanted to shoot it somewhere else. So we shoot in Vancouver, mm-hmm. but that scene was shot in Lone Pine, which is, I guess, what, like 90 minutes outside LA? Yep. So,
okay.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So we wrapped, you know, principal photography, and then everyone went their separate ways, and I started working on a play, and then we basically got back together to shoot this one scene, Frank in the Desert.
That's so crazy.
That was pretty intense. So we actually shot the Gina scene before we shot the Frank scene.
Mm.
So then what was it like then as Kito, who's had such a interesting journey this season, to be so kind with her at the end, because it feels like this is one of the few characters he can be kind with.
Yeah,
that we've seen him be kind.
That's
to.
True. Mm-hmm. True.
It was really important, I think, for me to sort of. One of the great things about the Gina character is that it's an example of seeing him out of control, which is because on paper he does not want to like her. I mean. She's not Japanese. She's a woman. She works in this hostess bar. She's all of these things that he's constantly arguing against or arguing, about the inferiority of. And yet he is so drawn to her. And as someone who really loves being in control or having to control everything, it's just a great thing for his character to have to deal with. And it was a really fun, interesting thing to explore with the writers and also with Dio, who, the actress, who's so wonderful. She and I were on Hemlock Grove together for 3 years, and we were friends, but we never had any scenes together because we were in different sides of the world there. And so it was so fun to have her come over, and then all of her scenes are with me. So that was a lot of fun. But that, for me, that was fun. It's fun to see someone who's normally so in control not be in control with her. And so how he tries to maintain it, and how his loss of control or tenderness sort of manifests itself, some people have suggested that, his behavior in the last scene is somehow related to whatever happens between him and Frank. And I think that that's an interesting take on it, part of his generosity there might be related to some kind of change that maybe he experienced in the desert, or some kind of atonement that maybe he's doing based on everything that happened in the desert.
I could see that.
Yeah, I could totally see that.
That he has his own personal understanding of karma, maybe, and that's his way of way of paying back for what he's done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think he does really like her.
So. Yeah.
Well, we definitely have to get into these last two episodes, but I do, before we get into that, I did want to pick your brain a little bit, because I understand that you guys are already shooting season 4. That already start happening. Obviously, I'm sure you can't tell us much, but maybe just share your thoughts on what you want to see for Kito this season, in terms of how he'll change as a person after all of these things have happened. And I know for myself, I'd love to see your character get more involved in you know, what's brewing between you guys versus the Reich. Like, it's really been Togomi who's kind of been at that forefront. So I want to see your character come there too and just speak on what you want for your character.
The world gets even, it gets even bigger, I think, in season four, if such a thing is possible. Bigger things are happening. The resistance is growing. I think you'll get to see a certain side of the resistance that you haven't seen before, which is really exciting. You start to get a real sense of, you start to get more of a sense of the world outside of just the world that we've seen. So outside of North America, you're hearing more about what's going on in the world. And for Kido, I think I'm really excited about it. You know, there's a much more personal side of Kido that you're seeing in season four. Much more of an exploration about him, not just via what he does for a living, basically. So so to me, that's really exciting. That's really all I can say about it.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, thank you. Actually, building on what you said, what you mentioned, I like that in these scenes we get Togomi. A moment, was this one? Togomi gets him in on the info.
Yes.
I like that we finally have that of characters. Let's be on the same page of information. And
Togomi. Yes.
Oh, so glad that he knows now.
That was satisfying as a viewer because you're both so important. And I'm like, just be friends and help because it's so frustrating watching you guys, you know, be at odds.
We, Carrie and I have become really good friends. Carrie, the actor who plays Togomi. And we sort of joke around a lot. We're like the original alt-reality frenemies, you know, like because we're so at odds with each other, and yet we also, after all of these years, have developed a grudging respect for each other, you know, because we're so consistent in our beliefs. They just happen to be different beliefs. Yeah. But so over time, you just you come to respect the other.
Nice.
So, yeah. Sadly, we have to not talk about Kido anymore. we're very sorry.
What excuse have gotten this time?
Well, of course. Like,
we're still going to talk about you, but
we're going to talk about the whole. Yeah, we're going to talk about you in the context of the whole show. We're going to talk about Ed and Children and the protest in episode 10, where they essentially hang in Frank's wake. I guess.
Yeah.
They hang his protest art high above so everyone can see.
I hope a lot of people see that because it seemed to be middle of the night that it was dark. I'm all, are people going to see it? Can someone take a photograph? We have cameras, right? Cameras exist. Let's take pictures of that. Because otherwise, I'm worried when they already heard the sirens coming. It's like, oh no, I hope somebody sees it enough to make a difference.
Or at the, I mean, even
or
if
someone take a picture of it and share that.
Well, even if it's just the gesture, the gesture's still strong. The fight that Frank had, that keeps Frank going.
Yeah.
Like that keeps Frank alive so long as they're willing to risk everything to hang a painting in hopes that someone might
feel resistance.
I think based on the way episode 10 ends, we know that it does have a lasting impact because Wyatt seems to keep the fight going. I'm sure we'll see more of that in season 4, which I'm dying to know because at this point I'm assuming he thinks Juliana's dead, so he still kept up her fight too. So it's interesting. I can't wait to see how that goes.
Well, you guys who say she's not dead, though. Last time you saw her, she just got shot falling under the...
Wyatt doesn't
know that, because he last saw her in the tunnel where they got separated.
The explosion.
And the explosion happened.
So Wyatt thinks at best she was captured.
Yeah, at best.
And then that bullet, if it splattered the wall behind her, I'd say it went through her, which is a cleaner shot. And so...
Ooh, nice thinking.
You know, because it came out the back, which is always good. It's when they get stuck.
Yeah, Oh boy, we're not gonna have time for predictions, so I'm gonna stammer about this a little. They haven't explained any, like, they're slowly explaining any of the multiverse rules that it's possible.
Oh, you can only do it if the other you is not alive.
But
I like that rule.
I like that, and I also like that it's taken three seasons for us to get like a third rule.
Yeah.
About the multiverse, so where you can only go to a multiverse where you're. Self in that multiverse is already gone, that you're taking the place of that person.
That makes sense.
But what does it mean if... What does it mean? Can they haven't established any rules at all of whether Juliana Crane can die in transport to a universe...
True.
To a universe where she doesn't exist. But she also... Also, if her blood splatters in one universe, does that mean she doesn't exist in that universe and someone else can come and take her place in that universe? That's what I like about how few rules there are this far in the game, where it's like they haven't said that can't happen.
Or true. What if she ends up in some weird limbo? Like, yeah. She doesn't make it to the other side because she got shot. I don't know.
I'm fascinated.
I'm loving either. Your smile there.
You guys are killing me.
We just know that she can't go out that way.
Oh, no, she's not dead. No.
She's our protagonist. It has to play out a little more. But I love what you said about us slowly realizing the rules more as the season goes by. And I love how much of that we got to see through John Smith's eyes. Because every time he watched the film, he realized something more. And we're realizing more. And it's opening up his mind to the possibility of what's next. So, I mean, you know, I'm so high on John Smith. I love his character, so.
Actually, wait, speaking of that, how disappointed, sad, and what with his life, his wife going, no, I'm leaving you.
Oh, man.
I didn't really see that coming.
Me either.
Because she was trying so hard to make it work, but I think maybe she just gave up.
Yeah, Helen and John were like a solid Bonnie and Clyde type team. It seemed like no matter what adversity they faced, Helen still had his back, but I think her grief, which we saw take so many different turns this season, ultimately led her to want to leave, because she kept saying, I don't want to lose another child.
Yep.
That, I think, fueled her to leave. Plus, she's probably scared of John now. He's only getting more powerful, so that means they're only going to be under more scrutiny.
I think he's changed. One, since Thomas has died, he's been different. Mm. And then that could definitely drive a wedge between a couple. And then the more power he's gotten, he's probably been more distant for her, that she's, I'm done, save the kids.
Not to mention, his big plan to save everyone, no one will believe him. Like, he could tell her, well, actually, there's a way to switch to parallel universes.
Yes,
in one of those universes, we're together and our kids are all alive and well and there aren't Nazis. And I'm figuring out a way for us to go there. She would definitely leave him then.
Yes. She'd be like, you're insane.
You know what I think it really was, though? I think it was the fact that John had to leave right before their daughter's test. And he promised her that they wouldn't come and do the test until after he got back. And that didn't happen. So I felt like for her, that was probably a signal that, like, they're not as safe as they think they are.
Yeah.
Because up to that point, John has been able to kind of protect them from every single intrusion into what they have built, and that was the first time where it was out of her control, until she obviously sent the nurse away. But I think that's when she realized, okay, we're really not safe at this point. At the end of the day, you know, the nation's going to do what it has to do.
Yeah.
So. Well, Carrie, what can the people do?
Yes.
To support this network and show.
Not only do we have channels like this one, but we have a lot of other networks as well. We have drama, reality, TV, and this one, sci-fi, which this show is interesting because I'm like, it's sci-fi, drama, a little bit of everything.
Drama channel.
And no other network works harder to serve television fans. So we need your help, and all we're asking is you subscribe to one or more of the YouTube channels. You know, click that little subscribe button. I think it's going to be on your, like, right-hand side or there. So also, you know, give it that thumbs up. And by subscribing to our channel, YouTube will suggest content that's tailored for you, and you'll help AfterBuzz continue to grow. And don't worry about the notifications. They're totally optional. You can turn them off. And so click that subscribe button, and now for this channel, and check our other AfterBuzz shows on other channels. I host on Animation as well, over on Popcorn Talk for Horror Movie News. Do you guys have shows on other?
I host
on Drama.
I do. I have one on Drama, and I also have one on the AfterBuzz Reality TV show channel. I host the Bachelor After Show.
Nice. And
I appear regularly on the Wrestling and Sports channel. All right. Also, the Netflix show on the Mothership, Sweet. Just AfterBuzz TV.
So, yeah, let us know that you did that, and we greatly appreciate it. And so, for now, thanks for being the best fans and for helping us be the ESPN of TV talk.
New Colossus. They tore down the Statue of Liberty.
Oh, children, that was so sad to watch.
Children could have done so much with just the torch.
Oh, children.
That's where his head's at.
Well, you know what, though? In dealing with, like, a trauma, essentially, that's a very way to be practical and not be freaking out that this icon is gone. So I get that. I don't think he's doing it for that reason, but I could see someone going, all right, let me be very practical about this, and otherwise I'm going to be freaking out. And, like, this, and then just someone who collects American artifacts, that's just horrible, you know, to have this icon destroyed.
Is there any room to freak out in this world, though?
Because no, I feel like that would be seen as you like... Are
well, unless you riot in the streets.
Which something Himmler encouraged, right?
Well, because it's... I think it's... Is it unclear, or was I not reading it correctly, that they're destroying American libraries? They're right. taking that as to take up in arms into the streets as nationalists. Did I misread that, or is it... Is it supposed to be a mess?
I think everyone's just doing everything. Yeah, everything, and he doesn't care. He says they're exercising their power, and I like that everyone else is logical and, oh, this is a bad plan. This is going to be dangerous. Well, and then you get shot!
Well, I do think from a propaganda standpoint, it works, because if there's just chaos in the streets, you can form the narrative to be, well, all this chaos was everyone seeing this incredible display, and now they're going to destroy all the American stuff.
Yeah.
That if there's pure chaos, you can spin pure chaos to be whatever you want it to be.
Sure.
But then, didn't work out for him. No. Himmler won't be there to do it.
Well, for now.
Well.
I don't think he's dead.
Yeah, okay.
I think he's going to die, honestly.
I think he could die soon.
I think season four will open in the aftermath of his death. That's where I see it going.
I think he's deathbed dead. I think he's not run the Reich alive, if you will.
Well, also then, if he doesn't heal well or quickly, he's at the bottom of their barrel of, like...
Of course, like, other people...
A strong leader.
Yeah, like, other strong leaders are going to step
jump up. Jump in fast, yes.
Strong leaders like John Smith, who I think is going to be forced to take over. I just feel like it's setting him up to be in the most impossible situation where he's, like, the leader of the Reich, and he can't try to save himself and his family, and it's either... He's going to fully buy in or be like the double agent that we want him to be.
Yes, I want to be a double agent.
And completely flip the system on its, you know, on its end and make for some really good TV.
Although someone who thought she could have it both ways is Nicole Dormer.
Nicole Dormer, you had a good pun there too.
I did.
Aha.
She thought she
could
be the golden child.
Yep.
And do whatever she wanted in America.
Yeah.
Not realizing that that was quite literally the test for her.
Yeah.
How will she withstand one project in America? And she failed.
Yeah,
and brought Thelma down with her.
Yeah, well, Thelma... Yeah, that's a good question. Like, what's going to happen after?
If that's how they're treating someone native-born, how do you think they're going to treat an American?
No, totally. And we were talking about before of, like, how much punishment, like, she didn't get killed. But they said you're having re-education. And we already saw what that kind of looks like. So I am a bit concerned for her.
Oh, man.
Because I do like her, and I was... Though, this could be her catalyst to be like, screw the Reich, this is not what I thought it was, and then help America.
I took the words right out of my mouth. Because she's the type of, like, firecracker kind of person who could really do some damage.
Well, if you want to get... I think re-education is going to mean one of two things for her. She's either going to become completely brainwashed.
Yeah.
Like Joe Blake.
Yeah.
Or she's going to escape and then join and help the resistance.
I think she'll do that.
I hope she'll do that, but I kind of like the idea. I kind of like the idea, especially if we're creating a power vacuum with Himmler, even being down for a second, that more strong people on that side can kind of come through.
Maybe.
We have about 6 minutes, so we can get into all the big reckless speculation about this final collider stuff. A lot went down. There were four volunteers.
Yes.
Three died.
Air quotes for those listening.
Yes. Three die. One does not die. Meaning that one person...
We hope they made it.
I think we're left to assume.
Left to assume, but you can't assume they safely made it somewhere else. They're just not here now, and they did not die in the process.
We can run with it for the sake of your prediction.
Sorry.
For a quick question, do we think that person ever comes back? Or do we think that the test subject, the woman who actually didn't die?
Yes.
So we think we're going to find out where she went and what that means?
No.
Okay.
No, that's I think that's a one-off. It just brings up the point of you can't go unless somebody there, your other you, is dead.
See, I disagree. Only because of what Joel mentioned earlier, that we're going to see more of outside of North America in season four. So maybe that person goes somewhere else and maybe we get to see it. I don't know.
Also, I think what they're going to learn, and I think it looks completely realistic, what they're going to do is throw volunteers, air quoted again. They're going to throw volunteers at the problem. And although the Manhattan Castle told them this, they're still going to just willy-nilly just throw people at the problem and see how many go to the other side and how and what and if and then perfect perfect bringing people to the other side.
Only John Smith was told that information. The question is, can he relay it to anybody else? Will he relay it to anybody else?
No.
So.
No, you're right. He's not gonna. He's gonna keep that information for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, gonna let them throw a bunch of people at the situation. Hopefully one will come back somehow and tell him about a universe where he's dead, but his son and his whole family are alive.
And he's like, I want to go there.
And then that's exactly where he's going to go. Anything else about this Collider business? I enjoy that this show is so well-written and character-driven that this is the first time we've gotten any explanation about the multiverse stuff at all. Like, from scientists, and even they are just, like, basing it from scientists from their perspective, where it's like, we had a giant collider and shot the things.
Well, it made sense to tell us now because the characters we were following did not know.
Mm-hmm.
So once they get that information, we, the audience, get it. And then also, finally, it's that payoff of, we've been waiting 3 seasons. Ah, we finally know something.
Well, it's such a kind of haunting and chilling scene where Dr. Mengele, I'm not sure.
Mengele.
Yeah.
Goes through just the whole demonstration of it. And it's so methodical. And I think that's probably one of the most drawn out scenes of this season, where we see every single, the test subjects being brought in and linked up and putting the tags on them. And you just kind of watch it all through again, John Smith's eyes and Juliana's eyes of just like, what is happening?
And he's happy. There's only 3 dog tags.
But also,
only 3 died. That's fine.
It's such a discount for human life in that scene.
Yeah. And to what you mentioned as well, let's not forget that, Togomi also knows about this machine as well.
Yes.
So I assume that the Kempei Tai will later learn about it, and that information may or may not get out in the JPS. So I'm curious to know how they'll respond to that device being there and what that'll change for that side of the world.
So I guess before we get to just predictions at large, I do have to reiterate, do we think Juliana Crane is dead in 2 planes?
No.
No?
I think she survived and made it somewhere else. I don't know which multiverse she made it into. Because the one we saw before with Togomi, she is alive. But we've already covered that there's many versions. So she could be in a totally different one. And the question is, what is that world like? And how much do we get to see of it?
I think it would be interesting if they set a fourth rule to all of this. That if you get shot like she was in this weird specific scenario...
As if she's like
The traveling revives you in some way.
Ah, okay, sure.
If she just wakes up somewhere not shot, I'd buy it. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess if she hadn't transferred, transported 1 second later, she would have died in that universe. But because she was shot in that universe while transporting, she just magically reappears in another universe. Also, the Togomi universe from season 2. She was a part of a resistance.
She was. She obviously protesting.
She was protesting. So that wasn't a super nonviolent time for protesters. That if you wanted to keep it really neat, that would be a way.
Mm.
That would be a place to put her that we already know about.
But would you want it to be someplace we already know about, or we want a new one?
I'd want a new one, but I think because this show isn't, for lack of a better term, Rick and Morty. Like, this show isn't about the actual travel. It's about these people. We might want to put her somewhere we absolutely know to get her.
That fourth rule seems very gratuitous for the storyline, but I'm not mad at it, only because it'll allow, different characters to maybe come back. Like, could we possibly see Joe again? Could we?
Well, and that's the third rule.
That's all I'm thinking. Like, could we see other people?
Can we ever have it where the traveler takes someone with them? Because the fact is, we didn't know she could even do that. Like, that sequence was so good. I think I actually cheered when it happened.
Me too. Yeah.
When John is running and you go, oh, wait, what is she doing? And then it works and you're like, yes!
I screamed.
I scared my dog. She's like, what? What's wrong? It happened.
So, do you guys have any predictions at large for the upcoming season before we... Joel, we're looking at you. Joel.
TV predictions.
He's like, nope.
I'm kidding.
Nope.
Thank you so much for sticking with us. You seem to be really enjoying us.
About season 3.
Great.
Just have great poker face while we're doing our predictions.
You really do.
I do see, like, sometimes Christina sneaking peeks at the monitor when she says something and I see if I'm looking at
it. anything, any cues I can get.
No, it's just a smile.
I'm reading you like the newspaper.
No, you do the smile smirk the whole time and enjoy the crazy theories we have. No, it's still fun.
I think we've exhausted all our crazy theories. I think it's time to head on out of here. Joel, where can the people find you on the broader internet and also on television?
What are you up
upcoming?
To right now?
Yeah, television and movies upcoming.
Well, I'm working on a show called The Man in the High Castle season
Well, yes.
four.
Yay! Oh, good.
And you're on Broadway, you said.
What's that?
Didn't you mention you were doing a show?
I was doing a one-person play called Hold These Truths, and it's I've been doing it for the last few years, and we just won three theater awards in San Francisco last night for Best Production, Best Direction, and Best Performance.
For our congratulations!
So we're very excited about that. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Joel De La Fuente. And all things will be posted there, I guess.
Cool.
Great. Thank you so much. Guys, tell everyone where you can find you.
Well, it's been so fun just gushing over season three with you guys. Thanks for rocking with us every week. You guys can find me on Instagram at Christine I. Alexis and on Twitter at Christine Bean with three E's. Share with me all of your fun predictions for season four.
I know, yes. Continue those with us. Leave comments down below because it's fun to read your thoughts on this show. And I know you want to go out there and find people who have watched it. And that's what we're here for and for you. My name is Carrie Lane. Thank you for watching. Thank you, Joel, for joining us. It was so fun to pick your brain about this show. You all can find me online at Carrie D. Lane. That's K-A-R-I-D-L-A-N-E.
And I'm Steve Kaufman. You can find me on Twitter almost exclusively at Steve Kaufman. That is K-A-U-F-M-A-N-N. I do a lot of cool stuff, including running YouTube pages for many wrestling celebrities. And I tweet about it all the time. Thank you all so much, and we'll see you next season.
Thanks, guys.
Our founder, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and me, Maria Menounos, would like to thank you for tuning in to AfterBuzz TV. Remember, we're not just the first, we're the biggest in the world, and we're the only destination for all your favorite TV shows. Whatever you crave, we've got it. So go to AfterBuzzTV.com and check out our lineup. Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.